March the 10th of 1983. It is 3 o'clock. We're in hearing room B, and we are hearing Senate Bill 42, Senate Bill 202, Senate Bill 130, and Senate Bill 197.
The first bill for hearing today is Senate Bill 42. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means relating to certain state liability. And two people are signed up on this bill. Daryl Rawls from General Services is the proponent of the bill. And Don Sutherland from Safe Corporation is signed up against it. Daryl Rawls. There's also written testimony from the Insurance Division, which is in our file.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Daryl Rawls, Director of the Department of General Services. With me is Stan Long, Deputy State Attorney General, who I've asked to join me to provide some additional evidence or information to you in some sections of the bill. The bill was introduced at the request of the Department of General Services, and I've given your staff testimony at the last hearing, which I don't know if it's before you or not, but there are really three issues that caused us to suggest that this bill be introduced. First of all, deal with the issue of a comprehensive risk management program. Secondly, to deal with the issue of negotiating workers' comp coverage for state agencies. And thirdly, dealing with protection of employees with respect to indemnification in the tort liability area. The first five sections of the bill essentially deal with the issue of the state's risk management program. In the last legislative session, the legislature created a risk management program to deal with all areas of the state's insurance coverage, not only tort liability, but also the restoration program and all the commercial coverages that we buy. We buy probably 75 commercial coverages, aircraft coverage, extraterritorial coverage, vessel coverage on the high seas, all kinds of special insurance coverages for state government. That's the assignment of the Department of General Services. When we went through that process, most of the legislative orientation was directed at the tort liability program. We did not spend a great deal of time looking at some of the management issues that would be important in setting up a risk management program. So we're back now with a more comprehensive management bill that will deal with some of the issues that we think the Risk Management Division has to deal with. Section 2 and 3 articulate those areas of responsibility. Section 4 deals with apportioning costs to state agencies for the cost of the program. Section 5 establishes a fund that would allow the management of monies that would be involved in the insurance program. Now, let me deal with a couple of the reasons for sections 1 through 5. In this so-called comprehensive risk management program, we're not dealing with what should be covered through insurance, because that's by and large established by other provisions of statute. We're dealing principally with how we acquire and provide that insurance coverage.
Could you move that mic just a little one way or the other? It's kind of got a wow.
Get some feedback.
Yeah.
How's that?
That sounds better, doesn't it?
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
We're not dealing, as I said, with what kinds of coverages should be provided. That's provided in the statute. We're dealing with principally with how we acquire those insurance coverages. On page 2 of my testimony, I, in the second paragraph, outline some of the management concerns that we have. We think that General Services or some state agency should be able to consolidate and combine the various related insurance coverages that we acquire through the private sector. Mr. Chairman, I have some additional copies if you do not have testimony.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brown.
Just to get me up to speed, Mr. Rawls, you've been engaged in this program for the last 2 years, or for the current biennium.
Yes, sir.
And I gather you've done so without detailed statutory guidelines. Is that a fair statement?
I think you're right, Senator. We have operated clearly within the specter of what the Ways and Means Committee and the State Government Operations Committee on the Senate side expected when this program was established. But I'm not sure that there is clear statutory understanding.
And that's where I kind of use the word specific, right? Or clear statutory,
right,
guidelines. But somewhere we hope what you're doing has been legal if we look far enough. But
yeah,
this will tend to give you a birth certificate in this area.
Good explanation.
Okay.
Make us legitimate. We are not certain that the Risk Management Division has clear statutory authority to acquire and purchase professional services, either claims adjusting or actuarial or loss control type of services. Although the legislature did authorize such programs in our budget, if you look at the statute, we're not sure that it is precisely clear. We also do not believe we have authority to determine the mixture of self-insurance versus commercial insurance. We self-insure some programs, we acquire commercial policies for some programs. And we make that determination in response to the marketplace. If it is more economical to acquire it, we do so. If it is more costly to acquire it, then we may self-insure it. Again, this is something that is well known to the Ways and Means Committee and to the substantive committees that reviewed the program in the last legislative session, but it's not clearly in the statute that we have that provision. Now, as we talked with our staff internally and with the Justice Department, we thought that the statute was broad enough that we could conduct these kinds of activities. But we were coming in with other agendas in this area, and as long as we were going to be before the Legislative Assembly in this arena anyway, we thought we'd just broaden these statutes to deal with the areas that I'm talking about now. I don't believe that those sections create any new horizons or expectations than those that were previously discussed in the last legislative session.
Was there a Senate Bill 131 that related to this that came out of Ways and Means last session?
Yes, Senator, there was, and that was the bill. Tort liability transfer. That was the vehicle we used for combining the tort liability program in the Department of General Services. And that was the major vehicle that created the Risk Management Division.
And did that pass?
Yes, it did.
What committee did you go to other than Ways and Means?
It was Senate Government Operations, and I believe it was Intergovernmental Affairs on the House side.
Do you recall that bill, sir?
Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, go ahead.
The one new issue that we are raising within the portfolio of authority for the Department of General Services is workers' compensation. So that's the second policy issue that I would like to raise. At the current time, no single state agency has a statewide responsibility of oversight or negotiating on behalf of state agencies with SAFE for workers' comp insurance coverage. By statute, the entire state workers' comp coverage is a captive market with the SAFE Corporation. It is placed by statute with the SAFE Corporation. No single state agency is responsible for oversight or working with SAFE on behalf of state agencies to deal with the issues that a purchaser of such coverage would be concerned about. The employees in the Risk Management Division have experience with workers' compensation. It was the Executive Department and the Department of General Services' feelings that we should designate the Risk Management Division as an organization that would undertake the representation of state agencies in negotiating a number of the discretionary areas with SAFE. Now, we are interested in how SAFE handles the investment earnings on reserves and how those are credited to the state's account, to the state agency's accounts. We are interested in the premium rating structures that SAFE uses as it applies to state agencies.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Rawls, is it my understanding that so far as state agencies, they're mandated to buy their workers' comp from SAFE?
That is correct, Senator.
Now, if that were not the case, if you could go out of the open market, would that tend to make the SAFE management a little bit more receptive to your and our problems, do you think? The thing that caused me to ask that question was the issue that we discussed in Ways and Means, where they won't credit you for your approximation of amount of time that people are off the job on sick leave or vacation, but unless you can document it in good hard documentary evidence, they're going to charge you with having all of the state workers on the job all of the time, and hence the maximum premium. That seemed to be a little bit intransigent as I view it, and if you could go somewhere else, you might get more affection.
Mr. Chairman, in response to Senator Brown's question, I think it's a judgment call, and we've had considerable discussions with SAFE, even though the Risk Management Division has no legal portfolio. We have no control of this area. We have, at the governor's direction, undertaken discussions with SAFE to see what might be done to reduce the state agency costs in this area. Those discussions have been fairly positive. We feel good about them.
In recent months or recent weeks?
Actually, in last summer and early last fall. We, however, do not have great leverage in this area, and it is our interest in increasing the leverage that state agencies have. We did discuss whether it was in state government's interest to be in a captive market or in a wide open competitive market. It is our professional staff's judgment that it probably is to state government's financial advantage to be part of a large carrier such as SAFE. We at this point in time have no interest in leaving that carrier. But we have a great deal of interest in reviewing how SAFE treats the state's account, how they deal with the financial end of our business. When we get moving from one type of insurance to a whole new type of insurance is a rather dramatic move. As we found when we moved from the commercial market to the self-insurance market in the tort liability program back in the mid-70s, and we just made many mistakes when we did that. It is our professional staff's opinion that we should start dealing with SAFE, find out what the issues are, find out what they are willing to accommodate us on, and go from there. We will not hesitate to bring the governor or the legislative assembly future recommendations if we feel that we are not able to achieve the objective with this bill.
I gather right now you're not a spokesman for workers' comp for the state government, so you only have that portfolio because you want it on your own.
That's right. No agency has a portfolio for dealing with SAFE. SAFE is the only agency with a statewide perspective in the workers' comp arena. And it is the governor's feeling and the executive department and my department's feeling we need some agency in there negotiating on behalf of state agencies. The whole objective will be to reduce costs. We have no staff in our budget for next biennium, no expenses in our budget for next biennium for doing this. We believe that our existing managerial people can perform this function. Now, the Section 6 deals with indemnification of state employees against tort claims that are filed against the state officer in the conduct or act of carrying out the public's business. Under current statute, the Attorney General decides whether or not an officer of the state is eligible for defense and for that indemnification. We also have a provision, though, in the statute, I believe it's let's see, I believe it is line 31 on page 2 of the bill, which indicates that by statute, a final court judgment may override the Attorney General's determination. In this situation, the Attorney General might decide to defend the employee. A court might ultimately decide that the employee acted outside the scope of the state's statutory protections. An employee would not be subject to defense and financial indemnification by the state. We in General Services are concerned about that. As the insurance agency, we are concerned about that because we have examples of where we have not been able to give assurances to the employee that they will be protected, and the employee has been in a situation where they probably should obtain their own legal defense. We end up with multiple defense teams, in some cases with contradictory presentations to the court. We in General Services, from a financial standpoint, would like the state to take the position that we either defend our officers all the way or we don't defend them. If we decide to defend them, or the Attorney General decides to defend them for whatever reasons, then we stand by the employee. We do not want to see multiple defense teams in the court. We could and are by statute required to reimburse the employee for their defense costs if they are successful in establishing that it was the state's liability. So we have a number of problems. We have a second team that may contradict the state's principles. We may also have to pay for that employee's defense costs if they are successful in defending themselves.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hendricks.
Under your bill, then, if the Attorney General makes, and either of you can answer this question, if the Attorney General makes a decision to defend, and then the judgment ultimately turns out that the person was outside the scope of their employment, or there was some willful or wanton act, then the state would pay in that instance, or what would happen in that case?
We would still be responsible for the defense and the indemnification of the employee, yes. Now, the one exception to that to be would be if the employee lied or misrepresented or failed to cooperate in the defense of the case, the Attorney General could subsequently reject defense.
But if they went through the process, made the decision, and then the judgment turned out the other way, then the state would pick up the tab.
That is right. And it is our feeling from a financial standpoint that it is to our advantage for one legal officer to defend our case. There may be situations of a very important legal principle of exposure that we want to defend ourselves on, and we simply don't want the employee going off in a different direction that might compromise our future exposures.
So, but then what protection are you going to have to try to exercise some control over, I guess, just the Attorney General's discretion to curb, because one of the penalties of being personally liable is hopefully you curb people's behaviors from denying people civil rights and that kind of thing. So, do you have any, obviously you must feel that there's going to be enough control, because that was one of the policies, I think, of the statute now, is to keep that personal liability on those people so that that would be a deterrent to bad behavior. So I was just wondering.
We've spent a lot of time talking about that. We obviously could not stand the public criticism of standing by an employee who is clearly outside the scope of their authority.
For example, then would you be obligated, if you got a judgment rendered against that, found the person was outside the scope of their employment or willfully or violating someone's, to appeal those cases then, keep appealing them?
Sam, why don't you go ahead?
If I may, Senator Wyers.
Mr. Long.
Senator Hendrickson, a couple things. Even with this change in insurance coverage, and I think that's the best way for, I know you're familiar with this act and I know you've worked with it, but I think for most people, the way to understand this is we're changing the terms of the insurance policy and not the terms of the statute under which the state and its officers may be liable.
Well, you're amending Chapter 30, though.
Right, but I mean
it's the duty to indemnify.
Yeah, it's the coverage part of it that we're amending. Now, there would not be coverage for the public officer employee who acts maliciously or with intent to cause damage or injury or with gross recklessness. So the bad acts, the employee or the public officer, is still on their own. This situation really addresses a problem that's most present in federal litigation. The federal standard for punitive damages, for example, is whether you acted in reckless disregard or in disregard of federal civil rights. What you get is a strange interplay between state and federal law. We could look at the defense of a state employee, and this could be a member of the legislature.
Or it could be a city or county employee under Chapter 30, right?
That's true, but the point I was trying to get at is we could look at a situation where a state official, and it's happened in AFS, for example, is doing exactly what this legislature told AFS to do. But then there's a challenge to that state statute in federal court. And the federal courts say, no, the statute's bad. You know, it doesn't comply with federal law or the federal regulation. That subjects, because you can't sue the state of Oregon because of the 11th Amendment, that suggests the state official who's done exactly what you told him to do to potential personal liability in federal court. This would remedy that situation because if we make the coverage decision first as a matter of insurance coverage that we're going to protect you, that coverage stays throughout the process of the litigation. Right now, we have to go through a really ugly scenario, and we've done it with some legislators. You get a complaint against you. We send you a letter that says, we're going to defend you, and it looks like you're covered, but if there is ever an adverse judgment in federal court for punitive damages, you're on your own. In other words, we cannot resolve the coverage question under existing law until the case is over with. Bradford versus Davis, for example, went on for 2.5 years with a lot of officials who were essentially blameless. They were supervisory people administering federal regulations that were in question, wondering whether they were going to be personally wiped out. And I know they called the Director of General Services, and I know they called me, and I just said, look, that's the structure of the law. And they said, well, look, can't you answer some simple questions? Am I covered, and are you going to pay? And I have to say, no, I can't tell you if you're covered. No, I can't tell you if you're going to pay. So we haven't changed the basis of liability for the state. We've changed the basis of indemnity or coverage.
Well, let me add it from this, from my standpoint in General Services. We have not changed, in Section 6 at least, the test of who is covered. But you are correct that the Attorney General could make a mistake. The Attorney General could decide that an employee acted within the scope of their authority, agree to defend them, and then the courts disagree, and we could be on the hook and pay the bill. We think that if it is wisely managed by the Attorney General, and the Department of General Services has a role in that counsel
process. I guess
the course
and scope of the employment doesn't bother me as much as the willful or intentional torts that state or city or county officials.
Mr.
Chair. Senator Gardner.
Daryl, I gather from your testimony that you're under the impression that the typical course of action is in the private context is that private insurance carriers always admit to liability at the same time they undertake a defense. Very frequently,
no.
They defend under a reservation of rights, which means you don't know whether you got any coverage at all. All you know is that they're on the hook for the burden of defense. That's very typical.
No, I realize that, Senator. But we're in a situation in this public
sector. And the defendant in that situation is in precisely the boat of a state officer. He or she or
it
corporation doesn't know what's really out there at the end of the rainbow, whether there's coverage or not. They know they got their legal fees paid, but that's all they know.
I appreciate your point, and I realize that. But in the public sector arena, and take Bradford versus Davis, which Stan talked about, we had a list of officials right below the governor all the way down to the first-line caseworker. Part of it was a nuisance case, but
yeah.
Nevertheless, we had all kinds of people involved. And we had the ultimate potential of having 10 attorneys in this case with contradicting points of view. We only got it resolved when Stan's people were finally able to get part of it dismissed on the basis that some of these officials really weren't involved in the actions that were alleged to have been improper. I am concerned about it from the cost standpoint.
Well, could I ask a question before we get too deep into the details of this? Subsection 6, page 3, why are you deleting that language?
I think so. They don't have to get another lawyer to protect their rights.
Well, we're proposing in subsection 5 to delete the court override of the Attorney General's decision. If we do that, section 6 is not needed because there would be no recovery of expenses involved. Once we're on the hook, we're on the hook. Is the position we're proposing to you.
Are you going to be on the hook in every case then?
Once Attorney General, after an investigation, if the Attorney General determines that the employee acted within the scope of authority, we're proposing to be on the hook unless the employee subsequently is found to have misrepresented the case or failed to cooperate in the defense of the case.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Henderson.
You know, in an early stage of litigation, though, it may be very hard to make that determination. How, and maybe I'll ask Stan Long, I mean, that's going to be a big burden on the Attorney General, although I guess they want to take it, because you might not know when you get the complaint served. You might, until you get into the case, you may not have any idea whether
we
the
have
allegations
that
are true. And that seems like it's, you know, taking on a big burden as far as the state's concerned, and also maybe exposing the state to having to pay for more of these costs than they had to under the presence.
We have something of that problem right now, even though there is an escape at the end of the trial if you're wrong when you went in to defend and then the employee's got to pay you back, etc. And that really has not happened. We've been fairly successful in terms of defense efforts. But we wouldn't make that decision just on the basis of the complaint. We'd make it on the basis, we'd make it down the road some way into that case, realizing the consequences of the decision.
But you couldn't take the case too far along and then dump it, or you'd have some
We'd have some problems. Yes, we would. I guess the principal value, well, I don't want to say it's the principal, but certainly one of the significant values of this approach is in the case, is in the federal court situation where we find ourselves increasingly. The federal standard for punitive damages is different than the state standard. That in and of itself is annoying. And the statutory...
We'd like to fix that.
Yeah.
Some people think the state standards are...
The statutory guidelines under which we operate, in effect, make reference to their standard. It just says if punitive damages are awarded, you're on your own. Well, with the federal standard being much less than ours, you've got a conflict, in effect, between the state and federal policy. We would think it more appropriate for the state to decide that question for itself as opposed to making reference to what a federal jury decides. And secondly, no matter how successful you are, you're going to lose a case once in a while. And in a situation where you've investigated a case on behalf of the state and decided to defend and go all the way to the mat with it and take that and don't settle the case and take that officer, a legislator, department head, or a minor employee of some kind, and you get a bad jury verdict, and they're stuck with the whole thing. That's not a good spectacle, I don't think. I'd rather have the state make its own coverage decision, so to speak, and be stuck with the consequences of that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cohen.
I'd like to look at it from the other aspect, then. If the Attorney General makes a decision liberally saying, on behalf of the state, we're not going to defend, at what point in time does the, what recourse does the individual have to get their own defense and go ahead at that point? That's sort of, at what point are you going to cut them loose? And could you explain a little bit about that end of it?
Right now, we have very few of these to use as examples, but right now we still cut people loose. Sometimes we look at a transaction and we know it's just so bad, it just smells, and we tell them, you are on your own. Mm-hmm. That didn't have anything to do with your job. It was intentional. Go away. We've never been overturned on one of those while I've been there, and I haven't heard any history of it. What's theoretically possible is they go ahead and defend themselves and establish that they were acting officially, they can sue the state back for their defense costs and so forth. But we've never had one on its head.
Okay.
It may have happened sometime in the past.
Oh, no, I'm just wondering whether this change would make any possible difference.
No, if we turn somebody loose, they'll have their shot at us if they want it.
We've left the existing language intact. I think it's lines 36, 37, 38, and 39.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've left that language intact. One last comment on this Section 6. I want you to be aware that this really was initiated by General Services and not at the request of the Attorney General's office. So it is our concern that we're dealing with. And the group of attorneys, which all of you represent, deal with a variety of legal principles, which I am not expert in, obviously. So I'm speaking as the layman dealing with my responsibilities for cost containment.
You don't make speeches about the legislature. Is that part of your point?
I would offer a second reason from my standpoint that I am concerned about. We obviously do have state employees who act inappropriately and outside your expectations and your authorizations, but we also have many, many employees who do the very best they can and do a good job for the taxpayers. For us to not be able to tell those employees, as in the Bradford Davis case, you did act properly,
which includes amendments from the state parks people, the Home Builders Association, as well as the Uniform Laws Committee of the Bar. They are not contradictory amendments except, as I've noted, at Section 2. You should also have copies in your file of the amendments as drafted, so if it's easier for you to look at them. You should also have a copy of letters from the Nature Conservancy and the Bar, and Mr. Bullivan, who you'll remember drafted the Uniform Act, saying that they had no objections to the State Parks and Rec amendments. Basically, what Parks...
Did Council get a copy of this letter from Mr. Bullivan addressed to
yes,
me?
Yes, I did.
February 20th.
Yes, it should be in everyone's file, as a matter of fact.
Right.
The problem with the bill as it came up before was that there was no repealer in it. There already existed in Chapter 271, the Public Lands Chapter, and 273, the State Lands Chapter. The existing statutes about conservation easements, you also have a copy of those in your file. All of those things need to be repealed if this bill is enacted. So that's been added in the relating clause. The Home Builders Amendment is at page 1, line 9. The letters from the Uniform Laws Committee, Mr. Bullivant, you'll see, and the Nature Conservancy are all opposed to that amendment. It would require basically conservation easements only in areas that are already designated as conservation or special resource areas in a comprehensive plan.
As I recall, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hendrickson.
The home builders were concerned, I think, that local governments would require the easements.
They would hold approval kind of hostage until the home builders voluntarily agreed.
And the Nature Conservancy is worried that if we put that restriction on it, then they won't be able to get voluntary easements.
Right.
So.
You'll note on
that. Could you explain the compromise then?
Right. Well, I don't think this is a compromise. Go ahead.
Excuse me.
Yes. Go
ahead. The State Home Builders Association proposed this specific language at this line. It also proposed conceptual amendments, which that's why I've included their letter. There was not a great deal of discussion of those amendments, and that language is not in here. What is in here at line 9 is not a compromise. It's simply what they proposed.
This is a menu, not a
right.
proposed amendment.
Right.
Okay.
This
Thank
is
you.
Just for you to be able to look at all the language that Thank was proposed in the design. Thank you. Page 1, line 19 was a scrivener's error. The language in the Uniform Act includes... also, line 19 was not meant to be struck out. That's just sloppy underlining. That right of enforcement should go to governmental bodies, charitable corporations, associations, or trusts, and that language had been left out. The State Parks Amendment in Section 2 had wanted to insert some language which basically would bring Section 2 in line with prevailing law. What the bar suggested instead is just to eliminate Section 1 altogether and renumber the rest of it as a preferable to that amendment proposed by Parks and Recreation. The Parks and Rec amendment is on the sheet that is in your packet, but it's not reflected in the mock-up. The only other change is on page...
Where's this Parks and Rec?
It should be on... You should have something that says proposed amendments to the Senate bill from State Parks and Rec.
I don't see that in my folder.
It's about half the top half of an 8.5 by 11 inch.
Jennifer Justice on the top.
Oh, here it is.
No, it's half a page. It looks like this.
I didn't get into our folders.
It was passed out at the hearing. I wonder if you do you have your stuff from the last hearing? I can tell you what it was. It's brief.
Go ahead.
Here it is.
On page 1 at line 22, after the words eminent domain, but not by the exercise of power of eminent domain, they would have added unless specifically authorized by law. And on line 23, let me see, they would have said, wherever and to the extent that a state agency or the governing body of the county, city, or park and recreation district determines the public interest.
But it's the Bar Committee on Uniform
right.
Laws that suggests we delete subsection 1?
Right. That it's basically taken care of by subsection 2.
Mr. Chair, I'm kind of lost on that one. Could you just explain why they, what the parks had in mind? I don't see written testimony by them, and I don't... I see that
there is written testimony.
Is there?
Why do you need that if you make it creatable like other easements? Counsel, isn't
I think it's existing. Right. I don't think it's
the bar's
necessary.
Right. I mean,
I don't think
is,
it's necessary.
Yeah.
And that's what the bar was saying. It's not necessary.
Oh, so what the parks, that is existing law, and the bar says they don't need it.
You said it could be created like any other easement.
That's what you don't need to.
Then you don't need to specify the precise mode by which it would be.
Well, isn't the language in the significance of that language is it says they can't use the power of eminent domain?
Yes, it's a restriction on
acquisition.
Which
makes it different than private people that would be doing that. So I was just wondering if the... Because I think that's kind of a bone of contention out in the public about a fear of parks and whatnot maybe using the power of eminent domain. And I don't know if that's any restriction on them to use the power of eminent domain.
It's not.
You
if you delete Section 1, whatever power they have otherwise of eminent domain they retain, you haven't limited their power. Of
yeah, but they wanted apparently to have this limitation on their power.
They wanted
reason,
to say that
know.
You couldn't use eminent domain unless specifically authorized by law, which is...
You're saying
there's no limitation. It's just what...
Restating the law.
Yeah.
So there might have been political reasons for them to want to have that in to assure people they wouldn't use the power of eminent domain, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But not legal reasons.
Not legal reasons, but political reasons.
Then it might be good to follow the state park's suggestion if it doesn't in any way harm the
So they're just restating the law, really, in this section.
Yeah. But there's... But that
maybe they're trying to quiet people's fears that they're going to use the power of eminent domain on these easements or something.
Maybe.
We could use theirs instead.
If we use the state parks proposed amendment, does that in any way, that doesn't in any way affect the subsequent language, does it?
I don't think so. The Uniform Laws Committee were not opposed to that language. They just said that, I think Mr. Bullivant's letter maybe pointed out that he thought that Section 2.1 and 2.2 were fairly redundant, and that they just suggested that 2.1 be taken out.
Okay, well then there's that question. Then you've got the repealers on at the end, and then we need to decide whether we want to the business on line 19 of page 1 is just a scrivener's error being taken care of, and then parks has added these relating clauses at the top. Then the only issue is whether we want to follow the parks suggestion or the Bullivant suggestion on Section 2, and whether or not we want to agree to go along with the builder the builder's suggestion on line 9 and 10. Is that right? Those are the decisions we need to make?
Yeah. I didn't explain this. In addition to the repealer, that last section on page 3, section 4, is basically, those are the Willamette River Greenway and Scenic Waterways statutes, and it's to bring it into compliance with the way that those conservation easements are acquired in those chapters.
Okay. Well, could I get a motion first on this amendment of the... Well, the chair will move that we adopt the amendment on page 1, line 2 and 3, adding these statutory references to the relating clause, and the scrivener's omission on line 19, and the additions at the end of the mocked-up bill, section 4, subsection 4 and section 10.
Is there any objection to that motion?
Those are purely housekeeping.
Those are housekeeping amendments. Is there any objection? Okay, that's adopted. Now, next, what do you want to do about the state park suggestion about subsection 1 of section 2 versus the Mr. Bullivant's suggestion?
It's the home builder's suggestion.
No, I'm down now. I'm down now on section 2, line 21.
Mr. Bullivant's. I'd move that we consider the deletion of subsection 1 of section 2.
That's all right.
That puts the law back to where it currently is.
Doesn't make any substantive change. It just deletes the politically advisable, maybe, language, but legally unnecessary language.
Right.
Well, I don't have a strong feeling on this, Senator Erickson.
Well, I just want to make sure that we are not, in fact, changing policy, because I was reading this letter, Jennifer Jasek's letter, and she said she put in the language. She said that there's some thought it's redundant. Her thought had been that she wanted to make sure that there was no change in the present Oregon law, which forbids local governments from acquiring conservation easements by the exercise of eminent domain, ORS 271.7201. Now, we haven't repealed that, have we, in our last motion? It looks like we repealed ORS 271.7201. If we have repealed that, I would think we better keep this language in. Because they may not have been aware when Mr. Bullivant gave that opinion that we were going to repeal ORS 271720.
Excuse me, let me read 720 here for a second.
It was the Parks Bureau that suggested repealing 720 and inserting.
So that might be why they inserted
it. That's why they did it, then, probably.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Brown. It would be my understanding that the materials in Section 2 are all entirely new.
That's because you have
to... Section...
Yeah, but we're talking about whether or not we're going to be changing the law. What is now existing law. And you've got this 720...
Yes, I'm nervous about...
Yeah.
Paragraph 1.
You're right. We ought to keep Section 2, Paragraph 1, because we're repealing it.
Because we repealed it up in the top.
Okay. Okay, Senator Frye. Then with the state parks proposed changes. Okay, Senator Frye now moves then that we adopt the state parks amendment to subsection 1 of section 2.
Isn't that just we wouldn't do anything? We just leave the bill where it was.
It says
on the mock-up.
It's not on the mock-up. It would insert after eminent domain. It would say.
Oh, I see. Okay, yes, sorry.
I had to read it.
Unless otherwise authorized.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
But Mr. Chairman.
And add state agencies.
Senator Brown.
The current law is in, I gather, this 271.720 parent 1, which...
Yes.
Which this bill repealed.
Now, if we did not repeal it,
then it would
then we could safely delete the last four lines on page 1.
Right.
And
I'll just leave it the same place.
I'm much more comfortable about, without having the current law before me, without digging it out of the books.
It's in your file.
You should add it.
Okay.
See, we need to keep that in there to be consistent now that we've repealed it.
But this just has, but not by exercise of power of eminent domain in 720, and we're... by keeping subsection 1 of section 2, we have that language in. Mm-hmm. And the Parks Amendment says, unless they follow already existing applicable law. Okay?
And why not why not allow it be a little more politically palatable?
Which this will do, state writing.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Well, it is. I didn't
Appealing.
It's more
important
to put policy.
Yeah,
and but rather than reversing it, what we've just done.
Right.
Okay. Does everyone understand Senator Frey's motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. Now, that leaves us with the question. Are we ready to move the bill out, or do we want to have a motion or discussion?
9 and 10. Right. That's the one I don't quite.
Okay. Well, this is a policy question.
Figure that out. Yeah,
this is a policy question. Do you want to hit it one more time, Counsel? Question at the hearing was the Builders Board, the Oregon Home Builders said that they were concerned that if we didn't put some language in to prevent that from happening, that local planning commissions and county commissioners would say, if you want to build this subdivision, you're going to have to, or this do this development, you're going to have to designate some of the land for conservation easement, or we won't allow you to have your permit. And the argument on the other side is, if we put language in that protects them, what is it there
for? We prevent the voluntary transfer by people that want to voluntarily give those easements that are within these comprehensive area, or within an acknowledged comprehensive special resource area.
I don't want to change the existing law, I guess, basically, which is in that respect. And it does.
You know what I would suggest is maybe this bill would be the vehicle.
Just one at a time.
I don't think, is the existing law limited to, in this respect?
No. I don't think so.
Well,
Mr. Chair,
I don't know if that's
right.
So. It would.
Senator Hendrickson.
I suggest if the home builders have a concern about this, that maybe it be addressed in a different vehicle because if this really is a problem, and I'm not sure it's a problem, what they're concerned about is local governments requiring this as part of subdivisions or partitions or something. But it seems to me the amendment they've proposed is much too broad for the problem that they've brought up, if there is a problem. If there is such a problem, we should deal with that in the chapter of the statute to deal with subdivisions and partitions and what requirements could be put on them and not on this particular bill. And perhaps a different bill or a different vehicle should be used to address that problem, because I think this amendment is much too broad and that... I would support legislation like that, but it would be more appropriate to put it in the subdivision in the partition chapters about, if we don't want local governments to do that, then to restrict the local governments from doing that explicitly, rather than using this very broad language that would prevent people who voluntarily want to create easements in this area. And I would suggest that, so I won't support this amendment, I might be willing to take a look at, and there must be bills someplace that have those chapters that maybe amendments could be brought forth for us to look at that particular problem.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a more appropriate course of action. This was, I just see from the letters here from Rick Bullivant and from comments of the Uniform State Laws Committee of the Oregon State Bar, the specific proposed amendment limits conservation easements to specifically designated areas in the acknowledged comprehensive plan. Such limitation does not presently exist in present law. Adopting this proposed amendment would emasculate the bill. I'm against it. So I guess I kind of agree that ought to be addressed separately.
And more finely hewn, as I understood the problem they were presenting is their fear of local government putting these in as restrictions on partitions and subdivisions. Yeah. So I think it would be more appropriate to look, if we want to restrict them, to look at that narrower focus rather than this blanket approach, which would destroy the intent of the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bryan.
Then I think it's probably appropriate to move this bill out as we've just amended it then, to the due pass recommendation.
Is there discussion of Senator Frey's motion to send Senate Bill 197 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation? Please call the roll.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator
Senator Cohen?
Aye.
Senator Frye?
Aye.
Senator Gardner?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Henderson?
Aye.
Senator Wyatt?
Aye. Motion carried. Public hearing is now open on Senate Bill 202. And first witness is Gene Modlin. This is the bill where we try and find out how much is a little bit. You just move it over a little, is it all right or not? I think. Is that right, Mr. Modlin?
We can use this to wind up with just one utility. I'm Gene Modlin, Deputy Public Utility Commissioner. I sent copies of my testimony to Ms. Bogan a couple weeks ago, I think, and they've been distributed. This bill makes several changes in PUC law. The sections aren't necessarily related to each other. I'll just go through it section by section, if I may. Section 1, under present law, any person who's a party to a rate case can request a blank subpoena to issue to any person who may have, they think, some information on a case. And that subpoena can be served upon a person whether or not he or she may have some relevant information. We propose to make this law read the same as it is for issuance of a subpoena ducis tecum, so that there must be showing of general relevance prior to issuing a subpoena for testimony. The last time this came up, there was two subpoenas issued on the presidents of Portland General Electric, Pacific Power and Light Company, to testify at a hearing at which they were already well represented, and they had no information that wasn't available from the witnesses produced by the company, so they had to file motions to quash and go through all that. It's a nuisance, expensive. They're big boys, and they can protect themselves, I'm sure, but perhaps everybody may not. So we're just asking that there be showing of general relevance, of relevance to the case prior to issuance of a subpoena, rather than just issuing blank subpoenas to a party to the case to issue to whomever they may wish. Section 2 is offered to update present law relating to inspection of pipelines carrying hazardous materials. The bill describes, we currently have law that permits us to inspect facilities for the treatment and storage of natural gas and for the shipment of natural gas by pipeline. The federal government has expanded its own law on this subject in 1979 to include petroleum or petroleum products or any other substance or material which may pose an unreasonable risk to life or property. That's not defined, but as I mentioned, there's a possibility, for instance, that an ammonia pipeline could be constructed. The federal government, we operate in partnership with the federal government to inspect natural gas pipelines. They pay half the tab, and the state pays half the cost. There's been no particular difficulty with our partnership in that regard, and it's worked well. The proposal is that we have to be given the same authority to enter into a partnership agreement with the federal government to inspect these other pipelines that the federal law mentions, petroleum and other hazardous substance pipelines.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Henderson.
Would this also give you, it also says hazardous materials that might be upon the streets or highways. Would that, for example, nuclear materials that were being, or hazardous waste materials, radioactive, that were being chipped by truck or train, would that give you?
No. I would apologize for this subsection 2 of section 2 because that's all one sentence, but our counsel from the Attorney General's office said that's substantially what present law says, and said since that works, he didn't want to tinker with it about
well,
all
it
that.
It says upon the public, but, the streets or highways, why wouldn't it give you that power?
Yeah, upon public streets or highways modifies facilities or pipeline, take the pick. And so all we're talking about here is pipelines or facilities for the storage or treatment of materials that go into a pipeline. There's some concern on the part of John Burns representing the oil industry that this may somehow affect service stations. John couldn't be here today, and he's going to propose an amendment to this section to make it more clear what we mean, and we have no objection to that. But we're not talking about rolling stock here in any way. We're talking just about material that might go in a pipeline, or that will go in a pipeline.
Well, if there's an amendment made, Mr. Chairman, I wonder if that awful long sentence couldn't be changed a bit, make it more readable.
Yes.
Maybe Mr. Burns would be willing to do that.
While he's doing it.
What is amended?
If he isn't, though, maybe you could
reduce it to suitable size.
It is 10 lines in one sentence.
If you have any trouble getting the Attorney General's office to do it, they'll let us know. We have a bill that's coming up that might help you with that. That committee bill we had, yeah.
Some concern also was expressed by Judge Denneke that it might affect propane installations, and we have no intention of doing that either, so he may come with an amendment also. Which is fine, because we are not trying to get at either gasoline stations, service stations, or propane.
If you can get all these ex-chief justices and ex-presidents of the Senate together and work this out, it would be good, because we've got a lot of bills.
The Section 3 present law provides that we must do an annual audit of all accounts of all regulated utilities. That's impossible. And with the present staff we have, and we've asked for two more auditors in our budget, but even if we received permission to add two auditors to our budget, we still would not be able to do that. We don't think it's necessary to do it either. We make audits of selected accounts and sometimes all the accounts of a company seeking a rate increase. We can make an audit at any time when it's necessary, and we feel like we can protect the public interest adequately with law that says that we may do it rather than we shall do it, because we cannot do it. And so we're just asking that fact be recognized by in the law.
It's funny, there were two people in my office today that didn't think you were reading those things enough. They were pointing out that all the money that you're allowing PGE to spend hiring poles and giving money to the Boy Scouts. And
giving money to the Boy Scouts?
Well, I don't remember Boy Scouts, but it was a
4-H.
The group for Portland Progress, the lobby group that Bill Wyatt, one of our former colleagues, is the executive director to, and I imagine they'll be giving money
anything
to one of these
sales tax
groups. But that'll be a future one. The one I was reading was a 79 one. This long list of political activity in the area of giving money to all different kinds of groups, and it's in the rate base. It's not coming out of the...
If I may, that's
expense.
That's not correct. That's below the line. The stockholders pay that.
Why did they call it expense then?
They have, as you say, they do have a great long list of contributions they make, and they have a great big long list of dues and memberships in various mm-hmm. organizations, most of which we disallow.
Is the
for rate making purposes,
Chairman?
For rate making purposes, but I'll get a copy of that and we can look at it. But there wasn't any political campaign contributions in the list, but it was membership. Are you saying the membership in the Capital Club is excluded from as an expense?
Yes.
It is excluded as an expense?
Yeah. Stockholders pay for that.
Okay. Senator Brown.
I was going to ask, in view of those expenses, which are considerable, I'm sure, is the return on invested capital adjusted upwards to reflect that, or is that not at all considered on return on invested capital?
Well, obviously all of the company's money comes from ratepayers. They're authorized a opportunity to earn a rate of return on their investment. Mm-hmm. It's up to them as to whether they make it or not. If they use some money for purposes that we don't recognize for rate-making purposes, then that comes out of the stockholder's share of the investment. So instead of earning, say, $2.95 on equity, they might earn $2.93 because they made these contributions.
In other words, you allow a reasonable return on invested capital
And then if some of that is bled off before it reaches the stockholder because of their own permission and consent, that's it's a free country.
Yeah, that's up to the stockholders is where they wish to do that.
But it doesn't reflect, the fact that it's bled off doesn't reflect in the computation of what is a reasonable return. The fact that it has been bled off in the past and never reaches the stockholders is not considered in determining what is a reasonable return on invested capital.
No, my statement was the utility is given an opportunity to earn what we regard as a fair rate of return. As a matter of fact, they do not earn that. The last time the gas company earned it was about 3 years ago, and they haven't since. And PG and PP&L do not earn their authorized rate of return, partly because of regulatory lag.
Section 7 is the one that's causing all the interest? No. Excuse me.
Sections 4, 5, and 6 are related to boundaries, territorial boundaries of the utilities. There is some controversy over this.
Just one second on that one. No hearings if they agree to if there's a reallocation of territory, no hearing would be required if all the affected customers agree.
And the two or more utilities that were making the contract for service. If they all agree, then...
There's no problem, is there, with territorial allocation? I mean...
Not in Section 4,
well,
as far as I'm concerned.
The reason the territorial allocation is immune from antitrust scrutiny when it's scrutinized by the Public Utility Commissioner is because the Public Utility Commissioner is actively involved in supervision and all that kind of stuff. Territorial allocation, absent such state supervision, is a per se violation of the antitrust laws. Have you looked at this particular provision from that perspective and satisfied yourself there's no problem?
No, and I'm not capable.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm not,
if garbage company customers divide up territories, customers, and exchange them, that is a per se violation of the antitrust.